we read in the 27th chapter of St. Matthew. We read in the 27th chapter of St. Matthew at the 32nd verse that as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. Now, Jesus Christ chose to bear his cross. It was his profound decision to die at that point in time. Bishop James Cleveland, a great African-American gospel leader, wrote a song called, "He Decided to Die." However, Simon of Cyrene did not choose to bear that cross. He said again, Christ chose to bear his cross. Simon of Cyrene did not choose to bear his cross. And what I want to talk with you a little bit about on Good Friday is how do we live when we are compelled to carry crosses that we would much prefer not to carry. Because you see, you and I have been compelled to carry crosses in our lives that we would never normally have chosen to assume and bear. Think about it. I mean, just consider your husband. You are bearing a mighty cross. He's probably mercurial, up and down, not very steady. There was a brilliantly inspired virgin in the Church of England in the 50s named John Collins. He was the canon to St. Paul's Cathedral and became the number one anti-war activist and anti-apartheid activist in the world. But I am told that he was very hard to be married to. He was highly mercurial, all over the wall yard emotionally, and simply impossible, although his wife bore that cross for 50 years. But let's just talk for a second about your wife. You know, she really majors in the minors. She's all about sort of things of this world and details. And you consider yourself to be an abstract thinker. And when you major in the minors, to live with someone like that is a cross to bear. Now, you know I'm not talking about you, but I'm talking about someone that you know. And, but let's think about another cross that you've been compelled to bear. I have talked to two women just this week who have been widows for over 30 years. Just this week, two women who've been solo for 30 years. Now, if that's not bearing a cross that a person was compelled to bear, that you never would have taken on voluntarily, I don't know what is. But let's go a little further with the picture of bearing a cross that you've been compelled by circumstance to bear. Let's just talk about your son for a second. Now, there are actually people in this congregation, I say this not because I know, but I know it in principle, who do not know where one of their children actually lives today. There are people right here who actually do not know the address of an adult child. You have a lost child. And almost every family has a lost child. And it is the heartbreaking fact of life. Clergy see this at funerals. We see this when the children fail to show at the funerals of their parents. Now, you were compelled to bear that cross. Would you, as his mother, have chosen, like Christ did, to carry that cross? Well, let's take one other typical example. Let's take your parents. Now, it is very possible for a person's parents to be a cross that you have been compelled to bear. A friend of ours in New York City married into a person of a fabulously famous family in New York and highly successful. Went to his mother's Fifth Avenue apartment every night for about 6 months when she was dying, just in order to hear his mother say, "I love you, and in fact, I've always loved you." And he never heard it. Not once in 60 visits. I've known young men who have wanted their fathers to say, "Son, well done. You have really done well. I am proud of you." But what they always heard is some form of conditional okay. Well, you know, if you have to do that, I guess. And again, there are people for whom their parents, or one of their parents, is a cross to be borne that we were compelled to carry. I didn't choose it. Had you known, would you have been born to that family? I'm bailing. I'm in parturition. I'm bailing. What I want to define life on Good Friday. Now, this is going to go a little bit. This is going to go a little bit under the surface. It's something I feel so deeply in my own experience. I want to say that life for many people is an exercise in being compelled to bear a cross that we did not choose to bear, but has come to us. On Good Friday, I want to just put out that possibility that life, at least in one or another instance, has involved you carrying a cross that you do not choose, but have been compelled to carry. So the question would be, how could Good Friday be a good word to you who are like Simon of Cyrene? By the way, Cyrenaica is a little tiny part of eastern Libya that you wouldn't want to go to today, and that's where he was from. How could the message, the word of God to the human being, amount to something that was good if you have had to bear a cross that you would not otherwise have chosen to carry? Well, I always get a little put off when people quote T.S. Eliot. And don't worry about about the length of the sermon. The sermon will end in a very normal time. I hope I will comb and card your psyche. I hope I will comb and card your psyche. But I'll do it in 18 minutes. God willing. What's good about Good Friday? There was an album in the 60s called Otis Redding Live in Europe. A huge success. Otis Redding Live in Europe. And the concert is constantly being interrupted by French teenage girls who are saying, "Sing good to me! Sing good to me!" And he doesn't sing good to me. But this sermon is an attempt from the Word of God to sing you a little song called Good to Me, to you and I who are carrying crosses that we've been compelled to bear. Now I'm going to quote from a poem by T.S. Eliot. I do it reluctantly because I consider it pretentious, lame, and flaky to quote T.S. Eliot too much. I just do. But this particular quotation from Little Gideon is so unlame, it is so diagnostically precise, and it's so powerfully good to people who bear crosses that they have been compelled to carry by circumstance, that I've got to read it to you. Then I'm going to say a little bit about it, and I'm going to go back to your husband, your wife, your child, and your father. And we're done. This is the quote, two lines from Little Gideon. Eliot writes, "Either you have no purpose, or the purpose is beyond the end you figured and is altered in fulfillment. Either we have no purpose, or the purpose of life is beyond the end we figured and is altered in fulfillment. Now, sisters and brothers, that is a profound understanding and telescoped understanding of your entire life from your birth to this moment in light of the crosses that you have had to carry and are carrying. Let's start from the beginning. Either you had no purpose. Now that's what a lot of people think. A lot of people actually think when the lights go out over at Roper, this is what they think. It was meaningless. It was futile. I don't see it. It was one huge impasse. The very things I wanted, I never got. And the very things I would beg not to have is what I received. There's no purpose. Anybody here heard of Bomber Harris? Well, Bomber Harris, Sir Arthur Harris, was the head of Bomber Command of the Royal Air Force during World War II. And he was an implacable and brilliant tactician. But he is supposed to have said on VE Day in his office in Whitehall, Bomber Harris, who in some ways Churchill thought might have won the war, possibly, Bomber Harris is thought to have said to an adjutant when the war was declared over, he said, "Well, we won, and to H with the rest." That's what he is supposed to have said. "Well, we won, and to H with the rest." Now, that is very powerful, but that is a perfect exemplification of someone who can say, "You know, I seem to do some good things, but life is an enigma wrapped within a question mark." But according to Eliot, and this is at the core of why this day is good, Eliot said, "The purpose of your life is beyond the end you figured and is altered in fulfillment." And what this means is, the only way you can understand your life and the reason you're here on earth is by understanding where you are today. You cannot understand your life by trying to figure out what you thought your life was about in your 20s. He says that if you want to understand or call good your life, you have to start with where you are in its stage of fulfillment and then work backwards. Now, what you and I do is we start with what we thought it was going to be about. What is the old story of the Irish bellhop who greets the honeymooning couple in Dublin from County Mayo, and he takes their hands in his, the old bellhop, and he says, "My dears, I only hope you'll be as happy as my wife and I thought we were going to be." Delightful pathos of such a true statement. You all laugh. The delightful pathos of such a true statement is that if you start with what you thought life was going to be like, you have to sort of be like Alfred E. Newman. "What me worry? I don't understand." But if you start from where your life ended or where it has now come, then you work backwards. And that is what Good Friday was. Now see, why did the Christians call this dreadful day good? Because they were faced with a reality. And they had to say, we felt that this man had something. So whatever he did, it must be good, and we must be wrong. Rather than, this is the end of the line, I'm incredibly resentful, and I'm going to go become an atheist. Oddly, paradoxically, mystically, enigmatically, emotionally, somehow they were given or inspired to say, rather than work back to what I thought it was going to be, this is what turned out, and everything else is altered as I consider this. This is why the church called Jesus' crucifixion good. It was inspired negation or negative of the daguerreotype.
It's an inspired truth.
And I want you to think a little bit about it yourself before we're done. Do you often look back upon your life with all its ebbs and flows and ups and downs and misstarts and misdirections and say, if only I had been able to control, resist, overcome, or have the strength to fight, that will get you nowhere, and you'll die completely lost. And you'll welcome extinction, you'll welcome the pills at the end in the hospice, you'll welcome oblivion, because it's a puzzle that I'm finding. And actually, it's more than a puzzle. It's a profound, wicked, malicious turn. But if you start with what has happened, and if you assign the word good to it, good to me, good to it, as the early Christians, then you'll have a kind of eureka that will interpret your life in a good, fighting sense. Now, I'll just say two more things. Let's take that mercurial husband. Let's just take the mercurial husband. Is he really a rebuke to everything you thought a steady, protective, secure man could give you? Or did he make you go deeper, far deeper, into the true nature of the human being? Because in fact, many, many people are mercurial. Many people are absolutely taken by their emotions. Did that mercurial husband of yours force you to go archaeologically to a different place than you would had you married someone like yourself? In fact, did you marry the right guy? Everybody say, not. Not. Don't say that. I'm saying that you did, in light of Good Friday. Now, normally I would say you married the wrong guy. Normally, I would say, leave as soon as possible. minimize your losses. Don't you say, cut your losses? That's what I would normally say. But in Good Friday, I would say, friend, it sounds like you married the right guy. Let's say the person who majors in the minors, let's say you get very sick of a person who's so darn concrete and specific. Now, she was given to you, so you would get out of your head and learn a little bit about what love is like. Do you know that love is not about loving someone like you? I mean, obviously, I think it is. But on Good Friday, we can be told that loving somebody is loving somebody who's not like you. It's the greatest thing that can happen. We've had to be honest. It's not just physical then. It's very powerful. This is very heavy if you think about it. I'm not entirely sure I believe this, but experience has taught me I believe it 80%. That is the next example. Your lost child. Well, now, on the one hand, you have to give that child to God. Only God can do for your lost child what you crave with every atom of your being to do. What you have to hear is that this is a prime directive in the fact that you can't control a human being. None of us here can control a human being, even with the finest and most noble of motives. The lost child possibly has been forced upon you, a cross that you've been compelled to strip you, because God's not interested in the person out there as much as he, as far as you're concerned, is interested in you. That lost child has been given to humble the very deepest part of a person's ego, which is the attempt to control another person. That's a speculation, but I think it's 80% true. The fact that you had unloving parents, or let's not say, because there really are no unloving parents, let's say withholding parents, let's say passive-aggressive parents, let's say not very animated parents, let's say not very physically lovey-dovey parents, well, that's probably God's enormous contribution to your life, to put not your trust in princes, but to find that love really doesn't ultimately come from a human being. But the only love that finally counts, and it will be with us in eternity, is the love of God. That is the love which never, ever is tainted or mixed or falsely directed. Well, I'll end with a brief story. I'd like to call this sermon, and it's the word I'd like to give you if I finish, Good Friday surmise. I like the word surmise because it's not an absolute conviction. It's not an assertion or a dogmatic affirmation, but it's a kind of a perception that something very powerful is within this. And I'm trying to get within Good Friday, which is so paradoxical, in a way that will actually speak to a real human being. And the surmise is that just about everything that you have thought was good is not so. This is surmise. And everything in your life that you have conceived to be and regarded as bad is in some sense the reality of the good, capital G. Now, I say that, but, and I had an experience in Charleston about this, and that's what I'm going to end with. I was having dinner once. I taught at the College of Charleston years ago. I was an instructor in the College of Charleston. And I had a colleague who taught the New Testament. But this colleague was not a believer. He couldn't have been further from being a believer. And I kept saying, why are you teaching the New Testament? This is the most neurotic thing I've ever heard. But let us not get into that. He was not explicitly not a believer, and he was teaching the New Testament at the College of Charleston. And I wondered one day, we had a little bit to drink, and I felt the question wouldn't be intemperate. And I said to him, have you ever, reading the New Testament, felt that you might be sort of being nudged by something real? And he said, well, there was a time. I was sitting in my study, and I imagined the first Christians huddled in the upper room after their Lord had been crucified that night or the day after. And I suddenly saw in my mind's eye one of the disciples saying, wait a minute, fellas, isn't it possible that this is good and not bad? Isn't it possible that the tragic element and factor of our experience, what's happened, isn't it possible that it could be Good Friday and not bad? And my erstwhile colleague said, at that moment, I suddenly began to tremble. He said, I suddenly realized that if the insight of calling that good were in any real sense the truth of life, then everything in my life would be completely turned around from top to bottom. And I trembled, and I resisted the thought, and I dismissed it forever. Now, as he said that, immediately came to my mind, and I was perhaps had enough wine to perhaps give voice to it. Sometimes it makes me tremble. And he, some kind of exclamation came out of his mouth. But the power of that story is that this man of total unbelief, very contemporary, very 2015, although it happened in the 80s, he suddenly got the idea, what if it were true that the cross I've been compelled to bear is actually the cross of God on Good Friday. And that in fact, the weight of it will make my life something enduring, something loving, something giving, something understanding, and something truly wise. That is the Good Friday surmise. And I sort of hope you'll go out over lunch and be so trembling that you really can't have very much to eat. Amen.
Right here, that's right. Sorry.